We are here with Cristian Marazzi, and I would love to ask, what do you mean by the concept of the revenge of the Fordist worker that you used yesterday in your speech?
Well, what I mean is that undoubtedly, by the end of the 70s, after this cycle of struggles, this so-called mass worker or Fordist worker, capital has reorganized itself in order to redefine the basis of accumulation, and for that to be possible, I mean, it has destroyed the Fordist working class by implementing a number of measures and forms of organization of production, which eventually, after 30 years, have generated a so-called post-wage kind of society, not because the wage is not there anymore, but it's not central in the definition of the social relations and political relations. And so by doing that, capital has destroyed itself, its nature as a social relation. Marx said capital is a social relation, and it has done this way precisely by proliferating, generating a plurality of social productive subjects, contracts, which we now call precariat, and which is in fact a plurality, a multitude of subjects, which in my way represent a sort of revenge of the old working class. Why? In the sense that capital has today a problem in terms of governing this society, in terms of getting out of this crisis, and the problem is that the finance and the financialization process has gotten out of hands. And why? Because it is terribly difficult to do what in the past, in the 20th century, the state used to do. It is terribly difficult today to integrate money in the real economy, for instance, to the extent that we don't have this sort of I'm not saying homogeneous, but anyway, a reference which has, in the past was for sure a specific productive figure, that is the Fordist industrial worker. Money is integrated, is proliferating in so many ways, to the extent that capital doesn't have a center in Marxist term. There is this so-called capital circuit which starts with the payment of the wage, and then goes on with the production process, and then there is the conversion of commodities into money, and so on, and then of course in the accumulation of profits, and so far, and so on and so forth. But this capitalist circuit is broken at the end, in the very beginning,
we're talking about stagnation.
We are in a sort of stagnation to the extent that that instead of generating a demand, what the economists say, the effective demand, they are generating financial rents, financial profits, and so on, because that's the way to make profit. In my view, somehow, this is a sort of nemesis, revenge of the working class, to the extent that that capital, by its very nature, needs a social relation, needs conflict, needs antagonism, because that's the way it has been strengthening itself, accumulating wealth, profits, and so on, but on the basis of this social relation.
So this is actually the reason why we can still affirm that the crisis is caused by ourselves, in a sense.
It is caused by this missing relation, in a way. I'm not saying that that there is no rationale in this. There is a rationale in terms of using finance, the creation of money, in order to make profits, but at the same time, it is a very unstable regime, if you want, unstable, and imagine the fact that the middle class has been destroyed. I mean, the middle class was essential to the, you know, to the coherence, to the government of society. No, so by destroying the middle class, which is the effect, the consequence of the destruction of this. Of the wage as an institution, right, and of the contract between capital and labor, and by destroying the working class, the middle class, in a way, it has generated a form of governance based on opacity, in a way, right? It is a problem for capital, and not also as well, not only for us, which is obviously a big problem for us. I mean, we are poor, we don't get money easily. They're destroying the welfare state. They're creating, precariat, exclusion, and so on. But it is also a problem for capital. I mean, and the way, at least in this period, capital is tackling this problem is by generating, proliferating wars. I mean, there is a parallelism between this diffusion of wars, of, you know, military kind of theaters everywhere, and this crisis of governmentality, if I may say, of governance. Wars are dangerous for not only for us and for those who are at the front, but it is also dangerous for capital. I always wonder how is it possible that they're letting the ISIS, right, these extremist terrorists, Islamic terrorists, why don't they fight them? I mean, because that's the reality. They're not really trying to no. So there must be somehow a reason behind this absurdity, right? I understand that it is difficult to fight terrorism and this new form of terrorism and so on and so forth. I'm not saying that necessarily that there is a, you know, a sort of a architect behind a committed affair, but nonetheless, it is something that we are, you know, we are confronted with. And take the other example of this Max exodus, of refugees. I think that it is something very impressive and very destabilizing from all many respects, but I also think that it is a positive thing that we are shaking up Europe with all these earthquake, human earthquake. But can you imagine what will happen in terms of conflicts between natives and this shift towards the right wing, right? I don't think it's healthy for capital. It is healthy for control, but control is not the best way, disciplinary control is not the best way to free all the productive energies that are in this society.
Last question. How do you think that it would be possible? How should we struggle over euro as a possibility of avoiding the closing up of the nation states on their respective currencies?
Listen, I signed a letter which was sent to the Financial Times a couple of months ago, 3 months ago, there was a demand by those that signed this sort of petition or anyway, whatever you want to call it, and that was to use this quantitative easing, right, to distribute wealth, income, and to the people, to European citizens. Because, you know, one of the main problems of the euro and of the of the monetary policy, right, by the European Central Bank is that, they're issuing, creating huge quantities of the cash liquidity, but they are integrating this money through the banking system, right? So there is this filter which represents a concrete obstacle to the integration of this liquidity in the real society, in the real economy. In fact, it is used to make profits in the financial markets, basically, right? And it is also used to nationalize the public debt, right? Because the Italian banks buy Italian treasury bonds, and so Spanish banks do the same thing. So it is a single currency which generates a multiplicity of financial spaces, right? which contributes to disintegrate Europe underneath, if you want. So why don't we at least start thinking that we have to bypass this filter, right? Yes, use part of this cash and liquidity in order to do what capital is unable and unwilling to do, it is to redistribute wealth for the reasons that we mentioned before, that is, that there is no an economic circuit as it used to be in the past, capable of integrating liquidity there where we generate demand.
So, Andrea, we know that basic income is a long-time demand of the movement, but today we have been working in a social unionism workshop where we have been approaching the idea of social unionism and the ongoing practices, especially in Spain, not only from the point of view of organization of the precarized labor force, but also from the point of view of organization of the exploited life, so to say, the society as its whole. So I would like to ask you, how do you see the combination of the demand, the struggle for a basic income, and practices of that kind of a social unionism that would precisely be wider than a labor kind of unionism?
I think that there is a strict connection between the idea of a new form of unionisms, we can call it social unionism, new form of struggle, we are talking since a lot of years of social strike. There is a strong connection between the new form organization of the new labor precariat and so on with the idea of basic income, that is a sort of a pillar, not the only one, of course, because it's a tool, basic income, it's not a direct goal, of what we can call a sort of a new type of welfare that is adequate to the new form of labor, able to reappropriate what is captured by the exploitation of life. So that means that the distinction between life and labor, it's something that is vanishing, is very strict, and it's impossible, I think, in my opinion, to make a clear division between labor and life, because many of the activities in life are nowadays in the new form of accumulation and valorization of capitalism is a direct source of value, not only indirect. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about a welfare that is able to be before adequate to this kind of a new situation, and we can call it a common fare, in which basic income is one of the main pillars. But we intend basic income not an instrument of income redistribution, but we intend basic income as a remuneration of life put to work and put, better to say, a life put to labor, not to work, because there is a distinction between work and labor, and hence to value. So basic income is a primary income, is a distribution tool, not redistribution. That means that basic income should be claimed when the added value is produced, not in a second time, as unemployment benefits, social insurance, and so on. That is quite difficult. First things to say is that this is a cultural change, because the idea of welfare is something that has to do with assistantship. It's something that comes after the distribution of income between wages, profits, rents, etc., etc. So we want to put basic income together with wage. So the struggle for basic income is related to the struggle for a minimum income, for a minimum wage, for instance. And the redistribution has to do with what we can call indirect income. And that is the second pillar of an idea of common fare.
That would be education.
Education, health, mobility, sociality. It means it's a free access to what we can call common goods.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have to distinguish between common, that should be direct remunerated by basic income, and common goods. Common goods is what we can say is the output of the common as input. In the anthropogenetic model of production, now common is a new form of labor. That means social cooperation, general intellect, solidarity, the new forms of labor organization are experimenting in a capitalistic way in order to disseminate individualization of labor, individual bargaining, that means social dumping, and to fight against social dumping, basic income, of course, is a good instrument for a new recomposition of precarious activities, and that is an input. The output, because if you are free to choose our activity, of course, maybe that a part of the economy is still organized in a capitalistic way, but maybe that if you are free to choose to a right to choice of your activity, you can organize your life and your activity in a non-capitalistic way. That means self-production, self-managing, production of uses value instead of exchange values, and that is this result is a common goods. This is especially the new common goods that are non-natural, physical common goods like water, air, environment, etc. But it's a material common goods like knowledge, first of all, education, solidarity, relationships.
Mm-hmm. It seems now that we are living this maybe unending time of crisis that there are two tendencies when it comes to basic income, namely the populist right-wing recuperation of basic income, which is happening currently in Finland, where the coalition of neo-fascist, conservative and neoliberal parties are putting forward an experiment of basic income. That surely will work as a new step in the workfare system in Finland. That on one hand, and on the second hand, sort of watered down basic income for a new social democrat cycle, so to say, that has unfortunately been since Vista Alegre also the niband of Podemos in Spain. This means basic income that is not given individually but rather to a family. So I would ask you, in this time that we are living now, which would be the parameters, like in real politics sense, that you find important to take into account when struggling for a basic income?
A basic income is characterized by four parameters. The first one is that it is something that is given at the individual level, not to family, or not to community in general, because life is individual. If basic income is the remuneration of life, of course it is on an individual basis. The second parameter is given to all the people that live in a territory, independent on citizenship, race, whatever. So that means that something not like the idea in right-wing parties in Europe that is given only to citizens. So that means that migrants are not taken in consideration. And the third parameter is that because it's a remuneration, basic income should be unconditional. You maybe that at the first level you can have some mean text just to make a gradual introduction of basic income. But mean test means also mean test related to the income level. That means we can start, say, all the people that is under the relative poverty threshold must receive the amount of money till this threshold. Then we can improve and increase the threshold in order to step by step it could be not only unconditional but universal basic income. That means that you know, you don't have any kind of construction. That means that the idea of workfare has nothing to do with the idea of basic income. The fourth parameter is that the basic income should be paid by general fiscality at different level, at European level, national level, local level. That depends on the type of struggle and what the movement are able to produce. That means that it's nothing to do with social security. Social security is something that is to do with indirect wages. That means pensions, what you pay, because pension is a part of the wages of the workers. It's not a gift by the state.
That is true.
It's normally is believed. So, and that is something. So we have to distinguish. We have to build up a sort of a balance, a welfare balance, financed by a progressive system of taxation. And that is the four parameters: individual, to the residents, unconditional, paid at fiscal level. And I think that if we consider all the proposals of basic income, is all very different names that are in discussion in Europe, I think that no one of this idea of basic income is politically taken in account.
I'm with Tiziana Terranova, and I would like to ask you, Tiziana, if you could explain what do you and what should we understand by algorithmic exploitation?
I think there are at least two meanings of algorithmic exploitation. Taking for granted the fact that you cannot really reduce the algorithm to a machine of exploitation. So, you know, it's very limited take that we are using now. So you could talk about an industrial algorithm. And this is the kind of algorithm that is used to regulate work. And it's the new mechanism of management of the new forms of assembly line. So we can think about Amazon, for example. We can see, we can think about the way they use algorithms to maximize and optimize the speed of work so that everybody can get their books and whatever they are buying within 2 or 3 days. We know this is happening at a huge cost to workers. The speed and the type of control that it's requested, the lack of autonomy, it's really a very extreme version of what Marx described in the Grundrisse when he was talking about the assembly line as this kind of monster which workers were appendages. So there's an extreme speed to the industrial algorithms, and that's a very extreme form of exploitation. On the other hand, there is also a kind of biopolitical algorithm which you find at work in social networks. In social networks, you have algorithms which are used not so much to impose their time on you, but they are algorithms which are used to extract a surplus value out of pleasurable activities. So these are pleasurable activities such as sharing and posting, and the algorithm kind of has parameters, because they are kind of they operate according to parameters, so which manage the kind of the feed that you see on the screen. But also, you know, and they also relate to the number of likes, you know, and what you're going to see, what kind of, you know, if you look for a car, for example, online for the price, you're going to find the car everywhere. You know, it's going to be in your feed because it's going to be associated with your desire. And that's an exploitation that it's kind of difficult to define as such because it's not at the level of experience. While for workers in the Amazon, they experience the exploitation. People on Facebook, they don't experience the exploitation because it's not realized in that moment, but it's realized at the moment where they find they're not being given the share of wealth that they produce, because you know the work is not acknowledged. They're just the commodities that are being traded. So they're two different kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see that it would be possible to organize, how could labor, this labor that is exploited through algorithms, can organize itself? Are we talking about hacking the algorithms or something else?
Well, of course, you could apply, you know, kind of pretty straightforward classic hacking methods. You could try to, you know, get in there, kind of mess up the machine. So they would require probably a high level of expertise to do that. Or you could do kind of low-tech things as far as the industrial algorithm is concerned, trying to mess up with the schedule and then trying to slow down the machine. So, you know, there's all kinds of discussions around that, especially with relation to Amazon, Amazon Turk, TaskRabbit in the United States. Trevor Scholz has been working a lot on this, of how, you know, to introduce some kind of resistance in this automated system.
But in the case of social networks, I understand it's more of a question about how to have that wealth for ourselves that we are producing through this pleasurable activity of social networks.
Well, there's been obviously there's a narrow sense where you can hack Facebook algorithms which keep you confined to your circle of friends. So the kind of construction of echo chambers, how you break the circle. This is something that it was discussed here at the Euronoma, the summer school. You know, it's been something we've been experimenting on, how you break out of your circle of friends. And then there is a larger sense, you know, which is about the form of property. We heard in London at a recent meeting of the Robin Hood Minor Asset Management Corp that really, you know, the kind of social networks should not be owned by state or corporation, that there was a massive amount of investment in these platforms of like disposable capital at the time of the crisis, which has allowed them to be developed and to kind of outperform peer-to-peer alternatives. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the mode of property of such global infrastructure should be a kind of different type of property, which it would be probably, you know, be peer-to-peer, and that would be the kind of hacking of the biopolitical algorithm.
I'm with Sandro Mesatra, and I would like to ask you, Sandro, in what way could we, this year, following year, apart from now, when there will be more and more people coming to Europe, from outside of Europe, help ourselves receive the help that actually people who are arriving to Europe are giving us in bringing down the border system in Europe? Also, not only in the external borders, but also in the many borders that divide Europe internally.
I like the way you ask the question. This summit was amazing. It was amazing. And of course, it was very tough. You know, we don't have to forget this. I mean, we have images in mind of shipwrecks, corpses on the beaches, on the surface of the sea. I mean, that's something we are not going to forget. That's not something new. I mean, it's going on at least for 25 years. Nevertheless, we also have other images in mind. And the March of Hope, the Freedom March of refugees and migrants from Budapest toward the Austrian border was really something striking, impressive. I would say that this march was, of course, very important in itself, but it was also very important, let's say, from a symbolic point of view. Because the march was able to kind of collect and multiply the political power of movements of migration. Movements of migration have been kind of challenging the European border regime again for many years now. This summer it was something special in a way, I mean, because of the number of people coming, because of the situation at the borders of Europe, in the south, in the southeast, we have wars. So there was also this kind of background, of course. But what struck me since the beginning was the kind of political determination of migrants and refugees. I mean, it was very apparent, you know, in their words, I mean, in what they wrote on posters, in what they said in interviews, and so on. It was very clear that what they were saying, I mean, we have a right to access the European space. This right is kind of denied by the European Union and by the member states of the European Union. And therefore, we have to put this right into practice. And this is, you know, the political meaning of these movements of migration. Going back to the March of Hope from Budapest, I mean, this march was a kind of catalysator and synthesis at the same time of this political meaning. And what I can add is also that, in a way, movements of migration are connecting spaces within Europe that have been violently fragmented and disrupted by the crisis, you know, and the way in which the crisis has been managed in the last years. And at the same time, as I was already saying before, these movements of migration are connecting Europe with its multiple outsides and are challenging Europe, but first of all, they are challenging us, you know, to imagine a different kind of Europe within a different kind of world.
And isn't it true that we should also remember that the people who are now coming from or through Syria are not only impulsed to this journey by Daesh, ISIS, but we are also there are many people who are coming that are directly leaving because the Assad regime's counter-revolution practically in Syria. So there are many people who are highly politicized.
Yes, of course. I mean, this is something we already experienced in a particularly striking way in Italy in 2011, you know, after the revolution in Tunisia, you know. And it was clear that what has been called Arab Springs was reaching European shores. And this is happening again, I mean. We know about the social and, let's say, civil mobilizations that challenged the Assad regime. And I think there is a clear connection between those movements and the kind of political determination that I was talking about before. You sense it in the language, you sense it in the behaviors, in the stubbornness, so to say. I mean, so it's again, you know, the long wave of, let's say, the Arab Springs, although it would be necessary to deconstruct this definition that is kind of penetrating within the European space. And this is a great challenge for us, again, both from the point of view of the way in which we can imagine and construct the European space, and from the point of view of the relations between the European space and its multiple and elusive outsides.
Thank you a lot, Sandro.
You are welcome.
I'm here with Alisa del Rey,
Alisa, yesterday we had a workshop on social unionism. In this workshop, I missed, firstly, having the departure point set in the exploited condition of the life as such, not only in the wage-labor relationship. And secondly, some pragmatic concretion about what could be the practices of social unionism. I try to see it through the example of political affectivity in La Paz, as well as the enormous political respect towards the bodies. I want to say I miss a politics of the body and consequently a politics of difference. I want to say that maybe we are more in need of learning from the feminist struggles of the previous decades than from the strictly workerist struggles. I know you have lived those years in Italy, and seeing you here today, I really couldn't avoid the desire to ask you, how do you perceive the current situation, and what does politics of the body mean for you today? The politics of the body means to recognize the difference. It means to recognize the difference that is not only biological, but also social and related to the dependency. What do I mean to say? I mean that the neoliberal individual, healthy, white, male, doesn't exist. It's an invention. We all depend on others, on moments of reproduction, the children, the sick, the old, also simply because of the question of relationships. We all need affection to live. We need relationships to live. Now, I believe that if we depart from this question of dependency, a condition that maybe the neoliberal capitalism has understood better than us, because it insists on this condition to extract surplus value also from it. Our social relations have become productive, and we don't realize that this extraction of surplus value is deep-rooted in the circulation of information, in the social reproduction, but it doesn't become welfare, but is rather lived as privatizations and a real subsumption of the life into the capitalist valorization. Feminism has continuously presented this level of not only of relationship between the sexes, but a project of a different life for all, which is assumed as the horizon of change. This becomes, in my opinion, the real revolutionary point. What are the practical steps? We have thought of many. It isn't true we aren't up to inventing them. There are moments related to healthcare, for instance, need of the individuals related to the alternative knowledge of the people that do health work. Hence, the capacity of building up a different mode of perceiving the body, the individual, not only as a sick specimen, but as an individual as a whole. With this, we are already witnessing a change in other sectors, such as citizens and lawyers creating legal counseling groups, where they see what are their rights and what are the real application of them in the society. Putting these two things together, they create a way of seeing in rights a new conception of citizenship, a new satisfaction of living in a safe society. Secure persons in a secure society, that is not a simple thing. We need experimentations that start from the idea that life is a whole. It's not the work and then life. It's not the salary and then the way of spending it. We need to reassemble differently all these things so that work won't be anymore the precondition for having access to rights, for having access to relationships, for having access to a social status. It is not possible anymore because it doesn't hold true anymore. This is conveyed to us not only as an image, as an outlook for anybody, as a goal to be met, but if we remove this goal, we discover it was a false one. There are a lot of people that live, that create and need relationships, while work, waged and precarious work, is for them just an appendix to this world in which we live, in which we all must build a common horizon. This is what politics means, creating a common imagination and a common goal, starting from the reality of our needs and desires.
Spero che sia chiaro.